Hello and welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Celeste Stein Show. I'm your host, Dr. Celeste Stein, and I hope you will be sure to go and follow us on our official LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages. We certainly appreciate it. You can also reach us on our website at bsaprinc.com. That's for Bishop Stein and Associates Public Relations. We have had that company 23 years, and if you're in need of public relations services, please feel free to reach out and reach us on the website again at www.bsaprinc.com. Now, although my next guest really doesn't need much of an introduction, I am definitely going to give him his props, especially for the younger generations who might not have had the chance to witness one of the most memorable Super Bowl plays in U.S. history. Today, Dr. Kevin Dyson, and that's right, I did say Dr. Dyson, is here to join us to talk about football, life after football, and what lies ahead. Dr. Dyson, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate that introduction.
All right, it got to give you your props. I went through it too, and it is nothing to play with, is it?
No.
Yeah, people don't know, do they?
No, football athletics, training your body to do something athletically, that's one thing. But training your body, I mean your mind mentally to do something completely against what you thought you were capable of is something
Right.
else. Um,
Right.
and but I learned as I got older, your only limitations are yourself and what you think you're capable of. You can do anything just about you put your mind forth to. And fortunately, I learned that after playing ball, even though I achieved a high level of success playing football.
Yeah, I know personally, I used to lock myself away in the basement for, hours on end, writing, and you have to really focus. I mean, it's one thing, like I said, to do sports and what have you. It's another to really engage in that mental playground that is necessary to accomplish great things, getting your doctorate. So hats off to you there.
Thank
One thing I want to say, for those who don't know, Dr. Dyson is a former wide receiver and a first round pick in the 1998 NFL draft, and he played six NFL seasons by the then Oilers, now the Tennessee Titans,
you.
and the Carolina Panthers. But today, you can definitely find him at the head of the class as he serves as the principal at Centennial High School in Franklin, Tennessee. And so I know that your name is certainly synonymous with two of the most memorable plays in National Football League history, the 2000 wild card playoff game against the Buffalo Bills and Super Bowl 34 versus the St. Louis Rams, dubbed the Music City Miracle and 1 yard short, respectfully, are definitely games that have hitched you into National Football League history. And before we get into that, though, tell me about, I kind of want to backtrack a little bit first, and I wanted you to tell me a little bit about your childhood and how you actually became interested in football and actually becoming a pro athlete.
Oh, I'll start there. I wanted to be a professional basketball player. That was my favorite sport. When I was in the sixth grade, I came home and I told my mom I was going to the NBA and I was going to buy our house. Raised by a single mother primarily. We did go back and forth between Vegas and Utah. My dad's from Las Vegas, my mother's from Utah. But my mom was pretty much our primary caretaker. And that was the ultimate dream to me, was to be able to buy us a house. We eventually got a house, in my mid-teen years through high school that I, graduated from. And then eventually my mom moved when I got to college. But then I ended up living my dream out and buying her house. But ultimately, I wanted to be a professional basketball player. And the next day, and it's funny, I just asked my mom this about a year ago where she got this from. But, and this was before the internet. After I told her I was going to go pro and buy our house, she came home with the statistical probabilities of making it in each of the major league
Oh,
sports in
wow.
America. And at that time, those numbers were astronomical. We're talking 1 in 1 million, 1 in 2 million. I mean, it was like less than 1%, right? And it was one of those things, 1%, less than 1%, 1%. And I just remember looking at that. She put it on the fridge and like, wow, that's the odds are really against you. And but it didn't necessarily deter my dream. And I know now, as an adult, what she was trying to convey was the importance of getting your education, being able to provide for your family, whatever that dynamic looks like, and things of that nature. She wasn't necessarily saying don't shoot for your dream, but you also have to be prepared for if that dream doesn't work. And so that year, right, the first semester ended, and I had like a 1 point something GPA in school. And my mom's rule was you had to have a B average or better, so about a 3.0 or better to play sports. And I came home, I'm the oldest of four, and I had that GPA was real low, and she took basketball away. And I literally begged her for the whole Christmas break. I'm just crying, pleading, like, how am I gonna buy you this house if I'm not playing ball? Like, just everything to try to appeal to her compassionate side, empathetic side of me trying to chase my dream at 11, 12 years old to buy her house. And I thought she was taking that dream away. But what I know now is she wanted, one, I had my little brother and sisters behind me. Two, she wanted to make sure I understand the importance of doing what I need to do in the classroom. Although I did just enough to get that B average, and I have some regrets in that sense, which has led me to where I'm at now. But and it ultimately it taught me valuable lessons. I finally convinced her to let me play, but it wasn't without some bargaining. I was progress monitored that second semester. Anytime my grades dipped below a B, I was gonna have to give up playing ball, which I didn't. I never got below 3.0 again. And it was just one of those things where it was a lesson I had to learn the hard way. And my brothers and sisters got to see me, crying because I couldn't play basketball. And my mom was ruthless in a lot of respects. I still went to practice. I still went to the games, but I couldn't play. And she that made me watch there and suffer through it. And there you talk about motivation. And so all that to say, yeah, basketball was my dream. Football just kind of happened. I got into high school, wasn't planning on playing football. I was like, I'm real scrawny, little skinny kid. When I got to high school, I didn't want to get hurt because I love basketball. One of my coaches, he had to be one of my teachers. He knew me from the junior high. He had moved from the junior high to the high school. He knew what kind of athlete I was. He just kept talking to me. Just come on out. If you don't like it, I won't bother you again. Just come on out. I went out there the first week, couple of days of practice, played in the game, had a pretty good day, if you will. And I've been playing football ever since. And still didn't take away my love for basketball. I just, okay, I'll do football till basketball comes around. So I would do football from June, July until November, December, and then basketball. I did basketball up until we went back to football camp. It was basketball was my thing. And that coach, man, Craig Hansen, I've thanked him a long ways because I was about to limit myself and my potential if I just focused in on one thing. And you just don't know how things are going to transpire, how you're going to develop. And that conversation or those conversations, there's more than one, convincing me to come out and play with my peers has it led me to the opportunity to get the college scholarship, which we didn't have the money. If I didn't get a scholarship, I don't know how I went to college. I would probably do some financial aid and things of that nature and had to do some research on that kind of stuff. But my number one goal was get the scholarship, and I was having success in football. We won state championship, and I had coaches calling, and it was, I can wait till basketball season or get the scholarship now in football, still play basketball in college, play both, and then I can ease that burden off of me because I wanted the scholarship. And that's kind of ultimately how I ended up playing football. I had the offers right there. I want to make sure I was getting to school, opportunity to get my degree. And I got that first with in the back of my mind thinking, I can do both if I get there. I could just like I did in high school. And that's how I ended up being a football player. I played both my freshman year, scrawny kid. And then I realized after a while, I wasn't getting no playing time or anything like that. I was still real skinny. I was like, man, I probably need to invest on why I'm here. I got the scholarship football. So I got in the weight room, lifted, and hopefully, I mean, eventually I developed into a football player and gain some muscle, and then, 1998, I was drafted.
Well, it sounds like your mother was a real tough lady. However, she seems like one of the biggest influences on your life, and it was good. It takes that tough love, sometimes, I guess, to get us where we need to go. And you also mentioned your coach. Were there any others that really, helped you along the way in terms of being a mentor to you?
And this is something I try to emulate even now what I do, because you just don't know the kind of impact somebody's gonna have on your life. You just don't know. And I think about, especially when my father was stayed away and he wasn't around as much. I think about some of the coaches and mentors that saw stuff in me. Donnie Greenfield, Randy Johnson, Craig Hansen, just guys that coaches that were influential and trusted in me and leadership and to lead the team, giving me that freedom, that flexibility, having the ability. It's a lot of people like that. And there's a lot of people, families that, because we couldn't afford for me to go play travel soccer. And I was one of the better players on a soccer team. And if I was going to be able to go, people had to take me in. So there's a lot of families that would let me stay with them and let me travel with them and would feed me so I can go to Denver and Idaho and Mexico and all these different places to play travel soccer. And same thing with basketball. Kelvin Davis, another man, gentleman who paid for my AAU, and just people that really saw something in me and knew our limitations financially, especially, and helped my mother along the way, so I could be out there and compete. And I'm kind of a rule follower. I wouldn't think I would have been out there doing something devastating to my life, like criminal or anything like that. But sport definitely keeps you in line in a lot of respects. You definitely stay busy. You don't have a lot of idle time. I was from one practice to another, from one tournament to another. And that was ultimately how I developed some of the competitiveness and things that I have now. And if I wasn't given those opportunities by a lot of people who just saw something in me, I don't know. I don't know if I would have made it to the pros. I don't know. I mean, talent wise, I think I was there, but also you hone in on your talents by doing those things. You're playing against people all across the country and across the state, and that's how you get better and develop some of those skills. So who knows where I would have been if it wasn't for a lot of people just investing in me because they saw something.
Yeah, that is so important for the people around you to realize how much their influence can be on a young person. And that's why it's so important to speak positively, but also I think making sure that when that tough love is needed, that you jump in and you don't just give a child anything they want. I mean, they're gonna try to definitely take it, especially, I know you're a principal now. I've been an educator for many years as well. And so I had to get tough with those cell phones. And we're gonna talk a little bit about classroom and those type of things. But first we're gonna take a quick break. And when we come back, we're gonna hit that topic, and we're also gonna talk a little bit about the things that you say to your students now that the roles have reversed. We'll be back in just a moment.
A lot of things have come to a screeching halt due to COVID-19, but you should know that the court system in Tennessee is still open and holding in-person hearings for orders of protection and other types of abuse cases. If you have a hearing date, double-check on where your hearing will be held. If you need assistance on an order of protection or temporary restraining order, contact the Legal Aid Society at 1-800-238-1443 or visit our website at www.las.org.
And welcome back. I'm your host, Dr. Celeste Stein, and we're talking to Dr. Kevin Dyson today, formerly of the NFL, Tennessee Titans, North Carolina Panthers. And we're talking, a lot about the trajectory right now of his career from pro athlete to educator. And I wanted to ask you, now that you have the opportunity, Dr. Kev, to actually speak to our young people, what is it that you tell them when it comes to being a student and an athlete?
Ooh, oh man, we can do this the show just on this.
Exactly.
Because and I've been fortunate enough to be on both ends of this, and I also understand I was that kid where my priorities were misled, misguided. I wanted to be a professional athlete, and that was I put a lot of my stuff in that proverbial professional athlete bucket. I'd go play basketball every day, or go lift, or run, and I'd go to the track on Saturdays when I should have been reading. I didn't read a whole lot. Because I got just enough on my ACT to get me into school. I got my 18, and that was it. And it wasn't now that I recognize I had the ability from an intellectual standpoint, from an academic standpoint, in academia. I learned that later. The same energy, motivation, prioritizing, attrition, all those things that I had in me as an athlete, I invested that in my education when I got in my 40s. And I'm like, oh, I've always had this ability. I just never directed it in that sense. And so I try to tell kids it's okay to, you got one, you got to be balanced. You can't just all be all in one way or the other. Even some of my kids that have 4 or 5 AP classes, they're wearing themselves out because it's all academic. And I'm like, you ain't got one time to be a kid, and you got to enjoy this time, enjoy this experience. And it goes by fast. And I try to tell them, get involved as much as you can to school, especially seniors. Do everything. Go to every dance, go to every game, go to every event, be a part of the school, because it's never like this again. And this, we started with the start of school, and we finished the first week. And before you know it, you're going to be in your last week of your senior year, and you're going to look back like, man, I was just a freshman. And we all go through it. We all have done it. We all had looked back and like, man, where did the time go? But you hear adults, my mom used to tell me this. I've had other people tell me this. Enjoy the moment. Enjoy where you're at now. But you're always looking forward to that next thing. Oh, I can't wait to be 18. I can't wait to be 21. I can't wait to do this. I can't wait to graduate college. And then before you know it, you're adulting, and you missed your whole quote unquote childhood. And my mom would tell me, Kevin, be a kid. I didn't understand what she was saying. I'm like, Mom, you're by yourself. I'm the oldest. I got to do this. I started working at 12, 13 years old. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and she would tell me, be a kid, enjoy being a kid. And now I tell my own kids the same thing, because I understand what she meant was, you got a long time to be an adult. God willing, you have a long time to be an adult. You got a short window to be a kid. And so that's one of the biggest things I tell kids is, one, you got to have balance in your life. But two, you got to enjoy this time that you have. Don't grow up too fast, because you're going to have a long time to be grown. And don't get me wrong, some of the best times in your life are those times after high school. College is fun. When you get out of college, you're trying to figure out life. That can be fun. But before you know it, it has to end at some point. You got to have something that holds you accountable. And some is family and kids, some is the job, but it's something that you got to find your passions along the way, and that will hold you accountable. But the biggest thing I can tell anybody, whether they be 12, 13, or 50 something or 60 something, is I'm trying to do better myself, is enjoy the now, and don't wait, don't invest for tomorrow, enjoy today. And I've tried to do better with that. Try to, if I find myself getting sleepy and not spending time with my kids, sometimes I feel guilty about that when my own self beat myself up. And I got to relieve myself of that and understand there's going to be days like that. But trying to do better with enjoying the now and appreciating the now, and not looking forward to, oh, tomorrow I got to do this, or next week this is due, or next month I'm going on this trip, and just focus in on enjoying today. And I'm trying to do better with that. So I have found myself of recent being really conscientious of, like, if I find myself like thinking about tomorrow, tomorrow's tomorrow. I don't even know if it's not promised to me, so I don't know what's gonna happen, but just go ahead and enjoy where I'm at to now.
Yeah, I think especially with social media and our cell phones, I notice so many people are always looking down. And like, are we missing half our lives now because we're not living in the now? We're living in social media, and that's a hard thing, and it's something that, as I started studying media ecology a little bit more, that's what I was kind of studying in school. I realized the damage that can do in terms of not engaging in where you are. And even like, if you look around when you go, say, to the beach, I mean, it's like a beautiful place and there's much to see around you. But if you look around, you'll see that half the people are on their cell phones. In as hot as it is and as bright as the sun is, they're out there, just constantly looking down at that cell phone. And so, wow, that's really a revelation that I think a lot of people need to really take the time to engage in what is going on in the here and the now. One thing, as you were talking, I was also wondering if when you were actually playing football during that time, did you really ever think about what you were going to do, after football?
That great question. I appreciate that one. I don't know how many people have even asked me that. They've asked me the typical question has been, "Are you? Did you always be wanted to be in education?" Not necessarily what were my thoughts as I was playing, and I like to believe I was always thinking, being prepared for what's next. In a sense of, I knew football wasn't going to last for long. I mean, the joke is NFL actually stands for not for long. That's the joke that everybody says in league, and we all know it. Even if you last 10 years, for most people, that's still early 30s, right? If you're fortunate enough to play for 10 years, you're still pretty young. But a lot of people see, oh, you have money, you have nothing to do after that. You can just do whatever. And I've heard that statement over and over again. I was first round pick. Like, why are you doing this? And things of that nature. So going back to your question, I was not prepared for life after football in the sense that I didn't have a plan. I was just, I need to play, make as much money as I can, and I'll figure that out later. Whereas as I've grown and learned, and I have my own podcast, and I've talked to several former athletes, professional football players at that, and how they prepared themselves for life after football, just stuff on from a limit to liability, their insurance policies, stuff that's generating income for them after they're playing ball, so they could do whatever they wanted. Because they already had a source of income beyond the NFL paychecks. Whereas I was taking it as I getting this money and I was paying bills, save, pay bills, save, as opposed to pay my bills, invest, because that ends up being the savings. And then you have these nest eggs, these entrepreneurial businesses and things of that nature where I could have been generating generational wealth. Compared to like, oh, I'm saving, which I'm good. I saved, I kept it all, but I wasn't necessarily understanding gaining and learning and investment and building that wealth. And so at that time as a kid, it was just acquire the money and save. And I figured that out when I'm done playing. Well, then my career ended through the injuries and lack of opportunities coming my way because people think I caught. And so I was 30 years old when I retired. And that's a young age. I'm 30. And so I started trying to figure some things out. And if I can go back and tell my 22, 23-year-old self, I would look into different opportunities to build businesses or companies or something to what I would want to do at that time, whatever it would have been. And that would have helped propel me a little further. But I also say this too, everything happens for a reason. I don't know if I'd have done all those things. If I would have become the man that I am today, I don't know if I would have went back to school and got two master's degrees and a doctorate and become Dr. Kevin Dyson. I don't know. And truth be told, that's one of my proudest accomplishments that I have is I did that. That was all me. I went back, I wrote a dissertation and became Dr. Kevin Dyson. Like that to me was one of my proudest moments. And I can't say that if I would have done all those things and I would have set myself up from an entrepreneurial standpoint and a business standpoint financially and things of that nature, where I was already having XYZ dollars coming in, if I would have took the initiative and had the motivation to do that. And I may not even be here speaking as an educator if I had done those things. So everything happens for a reason. But right. To go back to your question, no, I didn't necessarily have a quote unquote plan. I just knew I was going to make as much money as I can and save as much money as I could for when my time was up. And that was kind of my plan, if you will.
Right. Well, you think about it, only 1.65% of the population actually has a PhD, right? So,
right.
I mean, just the fact that you did that, I know you're way ahead of most of your counterparts, you know.
Yeah.
They've never even thought about it, you know, and most people won't. Most people don't. So, well, that's
I tell people I'm of 1% on both athletics and academia. So, you know, mm-hmm. So that in itself is a feat, and this is a whole nother conversation, but that's kind of what I'm focusing in on the book that I'm writing is, you know, being of 1% or 2%, whatever you really, but I say 1% on both ends of it. And the uniqueness of that, I was a first round draft pick, which is less than 1% of the population, let alone being drafted on top of getting my doctorate, which is of, like you said, there's only 1% of people that have that distinction. So, you know, it's something that I'm very humbled by and appreciative of. And, you know, you mentioned my mom earlier and her influence. I just, man, it was one of those things. I still, 40-something years old, wanted to make her proud. And she told me she was proud of me. She's like, man, we've got a doctor, you know, in our family. So it's just, you know, again, same similar motivations I had as a kid were some of the same motivations I had as an adult.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't really think about all that hard work. You know, they see the athlete and they see the accolades and they make all this money, but they have to realize that, you know, that money is in the here and now, as we were talking about, it's right then. And then, you know, you have to really be thinking, well, what about after that? Because a lot of young people, they may even make it in, but then, you know, their injuries, as you mentioned, and things like that. Yeah. So you do have to be wise with that, and realizing that maybe you should have some sort of a succession plan. But also, I just even thinking about everyday people and everyday life, I know that I was a news reporter, you know, for many years for ABC, and I was at one point working in a little small market in a little small town in Lynchburg, Virginia. And I remember doing a series actually on retirement. And that's something I had never really thought about. You know, obviously as a young person, you don't think about, oh, one day I might retire. And it was just amazing. It was eye-opening to find out how many people don't really plan for retirement. So even if you have a lot of money, even if you've had a lot of success, people, it, just because you have money doesn't mean you'll have something to do. Right. You know what I mean? Like, you have to really be thinking about, who am I? What do I like to do? Do I want to paint? Do I want to, you know, go horseback riding? What do you want to do? You know? So that's the thing, you know, what do they say? More money, more problems. You've got to also think about those type of things, you know, and do a better job. A lot of people, I think, need to do a lot of better at planning overall. I want to take one more break. I know we have just a few more minutes to talk, and I wanted to take a quick break. And then when we come back, I want to talk about the downside of, you know, being irresponsible as an athlete or an entertainer, and what can happen in those circumstances. We're going to talk about that when we get back in just a moment.
When it comes to relationships, there are some obvious signs you can use to spot someone who might be abusive. First, they have a tendency to want to rush into a relationship. They may also show signs of jealousy and mistrust, and you could find they expect you to be perfect and will try to cut you off from other important relationships. They could also be abusive towards animals and children. To learn more about the signs of dangerous individuals and how you can identify and avoid unhealthy relationships, contact the Legal Aid Society at 1-800-238-1443.
And welcome back. I'm here with Dr. Kevin Dyson. As mentioned, you played for the Tennessee Titans that eventually ended up in the Super Bowl in 2000. And the Titans had the best record in franchise history during 1999 and 2000 seasons. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that infamous play that we referenced earlier that is still talked about, you know, to this day, the Music City Miracle, where the Titans were playing the Buffalo Bills on January 8th in 2000 with 16 seconds remaining in the game. The score was 16-15 and the Bills were up. And now the Titans are ready to receive the kickoff. Give us a glimpse of what was actually going through your mind during that play. A lot of people, you know, they really wonder, you know, what was going on? You know, what were your thoughts?
Well, after Buffalo scored, I was on sidelines just getting prepared for what we like to, what we call the last three plays. It's essentially a succession of plays that you progress down the field, get yourself in position to either score, kick the field goal, whatever the situation is. And at that point, we just needed a field goal. And so we're having that conversation, and Coach Jeff Fisher and Alan Lowry, our special teams coach, they come get me. And they were like, hey, we're going to run home run throwback. We need you. We need you. And I'm like, because at that time, I didn't play special teams. I was starter and receiver in the National Football League. Only special teams I was on was what we call the hands team. And they were up. So I was like, why are they calling my name? And what happened was our number one kick returner, Derek Mason, he was out. He was concussed. The irony of all that was is that during that time he got his concussion, I was in the locker room getting an intravenous fluids because I was cramping up. And so I had to go get an IV in the third quarter to finish the game. And his backup is Anthony Dorsett Jr., who couldn't run because he was cramping up. So that's the irony of everything, is what led me to be able to finish the game led the backup, who would have been in that position, to not be able to finish the game. And so logically, they went to me because I returned kicks in college and things of that nature, and they knew me. And the setup of the play was for the play for the what we call a squib. And they put Frank, who also doesn't play special teams much, put him in the game to field the ball. Great hands. But again, they blooped it up. Doug Christie bloops it up. And then the ball goes to Lorenzo Neal, who, as great of a football player he is, he's one of the best, if not the best fullback to ever play the game. I think he deserves being a Hall of Fame. But his hands, he didn't have the best hands in the world. So when that ball went into in the air and he caught it, that was the blessing in itself, because he, boy, his hands were 50-50. And he caught it. He gave it to Frank. And Isaac Byrd, who also was in there with me in the back line of that kickoff return team, he was put in a position that was unfamiliar to him as well because of the injuries. And he got himself out of position. And instinctually, I saw what was going on. I stepped back and Frank threw me the ball. I learned some years later that Lorenzo Neal and Frank had a conversation right before the play where Lorenzo said, hey, I'm going to get this ball. Come get it from me. I'll block for you. So he kind of ordained it. He kind of knew he was getting the ball for whatever reason. And he catches it, gave it to Frank. And like I said, instinctually, I just saw I was the only guy there, and or felt it. I didn't necessarily see it. And the ball came my way. And I tell people over the years, I had the easiest job of all. I just had to run. I had to use my God gifts. And I could run long legs. And everybody else, they kind of did the job blocking for me. And I just ran. And I get a lot of credit because I had the ball at the end and I scored. And but man, them other guys, they did the work. And I'm just I just the benefactor of them and their practice time. They practiced it every day all year long, or not every day, every Saturday all year long for that moment. And it worked. It didn't go as designed, didn't go as planned. But that's life in itself, right? You make adjustments on the fly, and you make the most of your situations. And that's kind of the story I've been telling people ever since.
Boy, that play was really something to watch. I just remember everybody being up and screaming. That was wild. No. Now, let's go back also to the Super Bowl 34 appearance against
Oh,
the
yeah.
St. Louis Rams, you know, with the Titans losing 23 to 16. You were, you know, tackled 1 yard short of the game tying touchdown as time expired on the game clock. What type of emotions must you have had going from the Music City Miracle to being 1 yard, oh my gosh, short
Yeah.
in a game, you know, that meant so much to the Titans and their fans?
But that shows you the microcosm of life, right? You know, like the Music City Miracle is something didn't go as designed. I wasn't supposed to be part of, but yet it was successful. The 1 yard short play, I'm in the progression, it goes as designed, and I come up short. And at that time, and still to this day, it's one of the hardest emotional moments I've ever had to deal with from a sports perspective. It's the hardest. That was the first time that I could remember in my athletic career, from a little kid to that moment, where I wasn't successful. I'm talking, I've had the ball in my hand to win the game in basketball, shooting free throws, game-winning soccer kicks, game-winning catches in football. Like, that was the first time that I can remember, and I keep trying to think of any other time. And it hasn't been a lot, but it's enough. Like, I've played ball for 30 years, where I was not successful, and I took that to heart. I felt like I let not only a city down, but my teammates down, and by not getting in, and it, you know, it was very stressed. I got these stress cankers. I had so many. When I went to the doctor, they would take this acid to, quote unquote, burn them to help them heal faster. And the doctor, Dr. McPherson at the time, and his nurse, and her name I'm drawing a blank on, she felt so bad for me because they said, we have never seen this many at one time ever. I had like 20 something stress blisters or canker sores from that. You know, I came somewhat recluse for a little bit because I just feel like I was letting everybody down. And you know, back then you don't talk about that kind of stuff, but ultimately, yeah, I was, you know, living in isolation just for a little bit because I was so like devastated that I didn't get it done. And but then something flipped in me and I used it as motivation. I had one of my best off seasons, from a training perspective. I did some different things and I was ready to go for that next year. I wanted to get back to that moment and make that up to my teammates, make that up to the city. And then I had a devastating injury that pretty much changed the trajectory of my life and my career from that point on. So it's just an interesting dynamic. And of really, we're talking about an 8 month time frame where my life pretty much changed in a lot of respects, because, you know, here I go from this moment of, you know, heroism to almost like a, not, I would say villain, but a goat, if you will. I wasn't successful in the biggest moment, biggest game of my life. And to now I get to the season, I'm having a pretty good season to that point, and I get hurt in practice. And then that pretty much changed the trajectory of my career from that point on. So it's a unique story in that, because I've got so much of that balancing act of here's the good, here's the bad. And when I say bad, I don't necessarily think it's bad. It's a lesson in all of it. And I try to utilize those lessons for myself, even let alone with people. But, you know, it's just a moment now that I can appreciate, because I tell people this all the time. You know, the NFL is not made up of Hall of Famers. They're the ones we remember and we talk about. But the NFL is made up of role players. There's 1,500 spots every year. And of those 1,500, probably 5% of those are Hall of Famers, maybe 10% of the Hall of Famers. And that's just how it is. But we talk about, we remember the Hall of Famers, and rightfully so, because they've had great careers. But for me to still be relevant, still talking about it, still having moments in the NFL where people still remember me, still talk about my game and appreciate my time in the league, that's humbling and special, because there's a lot of guys that I played with that played before me or playing after me that won't have that distinction. People won't remember them, won't know their contributions, and they will have had great careers and people won't even talk about them. And they helped the Hall of Famers become Hall of Famers. So it's something, I don't mind talking about when people are like, oh, I don't want to talk about a Super Bowl. I'm like, why not? It happened.
Right.
It is what it is, you know, because I could have not been a part of that and not have that opportunity to talk about it is how I look at it.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, there's always going to be a winner and always going to be a loser. And I have a daughter that does pageants. It's like they always say, everybody can't take home the sparkly hat. It's like
Yes.
that's what it is,
Yep.
And so, if we talk about that and then we fast forward to, today, now you're a principal, I'm sure all that wonderful knowledge and insight that you gain from being a professional athlete, definitely, I'm sure has an impact on your involvement with young people now. So what are some of the things that you're able to convey to those young kids that you're working with in high schools?
Well, I think here's a joke, and it is there's some seriousness to it. People tend to think I was born in 1998, because that's when I was drafted, that's when I got here, and that's the most recent memories is me playing ball, the Super Bowl, the Music Miracle, all that kind of stuff. But they don't understand where my journey, and my journey wasn't as bad or as trying as some others' journeys. It was, but it had to. It's trials and tribulations too, and those are the life lessons and things I'm able to convey. And I think people forget the fact that I wasn't always a professional athlete. And so when I talk to kids in particular, I'm able to go back and say, because they nice kids now, they weren't even thought of when I was playing ball. Their parents were watching me play, and they're the ones telling them about me. So now they're looking me up. And so again, that's the most recent. That's what they know about me is I'm a former professional athlete and things like that, but they don't know I'm raised by a single mother, my dad wasn't around, all the different things that has helped mold me become who I am, and I can relate to that. So if a kid comes in and he's like, you don't get it, my dad has been in jail, I'm like, what? My dad was a drug addict and on jail too, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just so much if that I can relate to our two kids. And I tell kids all the time, there's probably nothing that you have been through or witnessed that I haven't been a part of in my own family, so there's a lot of different things that I can relate to, good or bad or indifferent. So it allows me to be well-rounded and still be humble to say, yeah, I haven't forgot, man. I shoot, there was times we were just eating cheese bread for dinner. You know what I mean? Like I was on that end of the economic spectrum too. I went to the pros and I was going to 5-star restaurants eating $100 a meal, a plate, and that sort of thing, So it's and I fall somewhere in the middle now. And I you know, so it's like I think the uniqueness of myself is that I'm able to relate to either end of the spectrum. And I love that I can still go down to a socioeconomically challenged neighborhood. I don't hate to say the hood, but go down there and still be relatable, and but also bump elbows with those people that live in multi-million-dollar homes as well. And I think that's a balance that I hopefully I can continue to have and appreciate, because not a lot of people have those life experiences, that especially being in the roles that I am now.
Right. That certainly lets us know that your past certainly does not predicate your future. And so you
Absolutely.
have to really be thinking that those things that you may have had to experience, they actually do mold and shape you into the person that you are meant to be. And
Yes.
so when we talk too about education, I know it is so different, definitely than when I was growing up. I think it's changed because I know I went to a private all-girls high school and they used to actually pull out the ruler and hit your hands and whatnot. I mean,
I had corporal punishment too.
nowadays you can barely say anything to anybody, but there's a lot happening, in academia. And I wanted to ask, I know there's been a lot of conversation around what kids should be learning from a historical standpoint in African American history, with some states even banning, what students have access to in school. As an educator, what are your thoughts on that topic?
Ooh, yeah, there's goodness. That's a whole nother podcast in itself as well.
We have a couple of podcasts we can do.
Man, I'll just start with this story. The news that came out in Florida with DeSantis and his changing of curriculum to emphasize that somehow Africans and African Americans benefited from being enslaved. And I had white friends texting me, emailing me, no, I'm in education, black friends, and I told each of them the same thing I'm about to tell you. If that ever becomes the norm for the state of Tennessee, where I'm at now, you won't have to wonder if I'm going when I'm leaving. I cannot sit there as a leader and tell my teachers, you have to, that's part of the curriculum. You have to teach that. When there's a lot of things I disagree with in education. There's some things I do agree with. There's a lot that I disagree with, and that's enough in itself. Because we do this high stakes testing, and I don't think that test that tells you everything you need to know about a kid. I didn't test well. I had issues with testing anxiety and things of that nature. And if I was completely defined just by that, I would not even be talking to you as Kevin or Dr. Kevin Dyson right now, right? But that right there, to sit there and say something to that effect and make educators have to teach that as part of the curriculum. You won't have to worry if I'm retiring. I'm out. I'm not doing that. And then I'll go be an advocate for the truth or for whatever else I could do from a different perspective as with Bishop Stein and Associates as far as speaking and things of that nature. You wouldn't have to worry what I'm gonna talk about because that's gonna be part of that conversation.
Most definitely. Well, and another topic that I wanted to briefly touch on, I know we don't have that much time, but one thing that I think is happening really quickly that we're not really totally prepared for is AI, artificial intelligence education. What do you see as, I mean, do you see it as primarily positive, negative, indifferent? Just curious.
I think if used right, it can be beneficial. I think it's a new way. Okay. So, teachers, this is what I told my staff this year. We can no longer, for the most part, use old keys with new locks. Sometimes the old keys work because education and teaching and learning, there's some things that are timeless. But we are in a different day and age in education where you have to change how you get into the mind of a kid. So with that being said, the AI aspect of everything, we've already been dealing with it where kids have tried to write papers from using AI. And there's things to catch this from happening. And of course, parents are trying to argue, he did not, blah, blah, blah. But we're like, okay, here's the proof and whatever. That's a whole nother concept, conversation. But I think there is some value in it if you can kind of bring the two worlds in a sense together, utilize. Like there's some graphic designing, there's some literature, right? There's some, okay, let's voice text this concept for this passage, and you write one that's comparative to what they wrote compared to what you wrote. There's some different ways you can do it because I don't know if you've ever used it. I've used it a couple of times just because people have been telling me to. And I'm like, okay, let me check this out. And sure enough, you're like, oh, wow, this is pretty impressive. And it's literally in seconds. But if you don't fact check it or do your homework with it, which you end up doing a lot of the work anyway, you're going to be writing something that's not factual because it's just pulling information from all over that it doesn't necessarily have yet. So,
Yep, that's so true.
yeah, so there is some value in it, but it's got to be harnessed the right way. And I'm interested to see where education goes in the next 5 years as AI develops a bigger database, because that's going to be interesting. Because right now, with everything technology and shortage of teachers, it's only a matter of time before AI becomes the teacher in a lot of respects, as we have
Well, you're
online
going to have,
classrooms.
yeah, the humanoid robots coming in and teaching the classes. And That's going to cut out some problems. But like you said, the couple of times I've used it, I'm like, well, this is darn pretty darn good, but it's missing this, it's missing a quote or it's missing something. You do have to check it, but yeah, they're going to be, I guess there's software platforms they're developing right now and have developed that can catch a paper that's been written using AI. But it's so funny. When I was having to take the graduate record examination to get into the doctoral program, I had to take it again, unfortunately, because it 10 years had lapsed or whatever. But I went in and I realized how different things are in that. They told me, first of all, I had to take all of my belongings and put them in a locker. Then the next thing was I was patted down. They checked my glasses to make sure there were no recording devices. I was like, this is crazy. Like, it is totally different. The means and ways in which people can use some of this technology, even having to put statements in the syllabus regarding whether you wish to be recorded or not. I mean, those are things that back in the day, teachers didn't have to worry about all that or being recorded, and then it's on social media, and it's just so much.
So
Like,
it's too much.
yeah, it's way too much. It's like you're doing too much. Yeah, like we got to come up with something here. I mean, so yeah, I spent about 18 years in the classroom, K through college. I've worked with every grade level at this point. And I see a lot of hope. I see a lot of positive things, as I'm sure you do. But and it's something people have to do. I mean, I think people had a new healthy respect for teachers after COVID. I'm like, they have no idea, what goes on in a day. So it's a lot happening there. But I think one of the things when we talk about education and being an athlete, it's obvious that every young man or woman will never play or professional sports, if you will. And right now, I think I read that it's estimated that every one in 1,282 high school football players actually gets drafted. So obviously, that means you better have some sort of succession plan, as we've talked about. When do you think parents need to actually start having that talk with their children?
In regards to AI or
No, no,
regards
no. I'm
to
talking about in regards to being a professional athlete, like it's so different. I mean, the odds are still stacked against you, though.
Well, I think as early as when that becomes their dream, right? I think you have a candid conversation with them. I think you don't want to deter anybody from their dream, but I think they have a candid conversation of the work that entails and being honest about the numbers. And that's why I can appreciate what my mother did with me, because you're not thinking beyond that small scope of I'm the best player in my area or my school or in my region, compared to there is only 8 to 10 schools in my district, and then there's 8 to 10 schools in the district next to me, 8 to 10 in the district next to that one. Oh, wait, we're only one section. There's 50 other states, there's 49 other states. And that number of opportunities lessens and lessens and lessens more. So being honest about and candid about that helps me, because my work ethic was probably a little bit different. Again, like I said, my focus was on sport more so than it was academia. But and making understand that if that's your dream, go after it. But you have to go after it wholeheartedly. You have to do what it takes. You can't be out partying. You can't be out doing some of these things that's going to deter you from the dream. Now, you can't have, I'm saying you can't go have a good time, but like I tell the kids now, I wasn't going to let anything deter me from my dream. I was going to have fun, but I wasn't going to go too far left, because my dream was to play in the NBA and eventually became play in the NFL. So whatever age that is, that becomes their dream, that's when you have that conversation. And for me, it was like 11, 12 years old. And my mom, she went a route where she put the numbers in front of me. And you know, it was disheartening and things, but it also was motivation because I wanted to be that one percenter. And it ended up working out for me. But I worked my tail off for it along the way. But she wanted me to have that balance in life, and I learned that lesson later. But I was doing it, but I didn't know why I was doing the quote unquote balance thing back then. I just knew my mom said I had to have this to play, and that's what I was going to do. And I realized now that lesson is what has carried me to who I am today. It was okay, that's your dream, you can go after it, but you gotta have balance in life because there's other things to life than just quote unquote being a professional athlete or being the next biggest rapper in the world or whatever it may be that everybody your ambitions are. Is, you know, you just don't know how you're going to develop mentally. You don't know how you're going to develop physically. You know, by the time you're 19, 20 years old, you know that your trajectory might change. You might have an injury. Now what? Now what's your
Yeah,
dreams? You know?
so true, so true. Well, I'm looking at the clock. Unfortunately, I think we're right at about out of time. But this has been wonderful. It went by so quickly. Just some wonderful words of wisdom that you've shared with us, and I really do appreciate that. I'm so thankful to have you a part of the Bishop Stein and Associates Speakers Bureau. I know you're going to be talking to corporations on leading and leading with grit. And I am happy to report that if people would like you to speak at their next event, they can reach you through the Speakers Bureau at www.bsaprinc.com. So we hope to see you out there more sharing this wonderful message. I thank you so much again for joining us today. We'll be back with the Celeste Stein Show in 2 weeks on BBS Radio. Thanks for watching.